Welcome to the 14th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast, a show co-hosted by Eric Drysdale and Jared Hunter. We aim to have interesting conversations with the people we know in a wide range of fields, including the arts, politics, and statistics. In today's episode, we are joined by Albert Tam, who recently transitioned from risk management to data management, has a diverse CV encompassing work from live events to finance in both the public and private sector. Today, we'll be getting a glimpse into some of the directions his field is moving and insight into the skills it takes to succeed in this rapidly changing business environment. Albert, thanks for coming onto the podcast today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
As we normally start out, if you could give us like a brief introduction about how you got to where you are and some of the career decisions you might have made recently or whatnot.
Yeah, happy to. So I started out actually, Jared, you and I were classmates at York University, right?
So yes.
Yeah.
So I, that is super useful BFA.
Yeah, super useful. Well, hey, you know what? Like we both work in completely different fields now, so it's an indication of the value that the BFA gave us. But yeah, I'll speak to like how I got here to where I am today and where I started. And you know, in high school, I was good at a lot of things, but there were a couple things that really made me happy, and one of them was, you know, they call it drama class in high school. So I was like, hey, let's do that. You know, I ended up going to York to do a theater degree. And I like that because at York, you start your first year and they don't really assign you to any one stream. Like you're going to be an actor, you're going to be a designer, you're going to be a production person. So it gave me a really great breadth. And I realized I was really great at the production side, specifically keeping things organized and keeping people organized. So I went to the production management stream. So I did that. And then when I graduated, lucky enough to get a placement out at the Banff Center in Alberta, where I got to work with, you know, so many great Canadian artists, got exposed to, the industry. But the problem was ultimately was there was a realization at one point when I was, you know, working out there, which was, hey, like, you know, I'm working on these shows, but if I wanted to be a paying patron to see these shows, I actually wouldn't be able to afford a ticket. And that really, that kind of irked me because deep down, like I joined the arts because I loved experiencing the arts and seeing the arts and all that sort of stuff. So I said to myself, you know, like what's a path for me to be able to be, an advocate for the arts while also still being involved somewhat in the industry. So I said, you know what, like, why not let's do a business thing. Let's go do an MBA. So I went ahead and did an MBA with the original goal of working in the not-for-profit sector, either in business development or fundraising. But, you know, things sort of change when you're in school. You get exposed to a lot of different courses and people. And when I graduated, like what was great was I got a placement at the Pan Am Games, which was being run by the Ontario government. And that was great because it was like a marriage between my event experience and my business experience. And it was a risk management job. And so I did that, but it was a contract. And as it kind of wound down to an end, I had really nothing lined up at all. And then the Treasury Board, which basically is the, you know, a ministry of the government that, you know, finances things. They're like, hey, who did risk management on the Pan Am Games? Like, I think we need some risk management here in the central agency of government that decides major multi-million dollar decisions. And because the Pan Am Games had such a small risk team, I was like, yeah, sure, I'll raise my hand. I've got nothing lined up. So I went up there, moved over to Workplace Safety and Insurance Board and risk management as well. Realized I wanted to do something different. And so I went over to Bay Street and joined a bank working in risk management there. And I worked in risk management for about 5 years. And I realized, you know, I think it's time to do something different. And the company, they're like, hey, we've got a data management role available. Are you interested? And in my head, I'm like, yeah, I think data management is becoming more and more important. People's awareness of the information they have out there is becoming more and more prevalent. And so it felt like a great area to try and explore. And that's kind of a long story. I don't know. It was kind of a long-winded answer, but that's been the last, I guess, what, 15 years of my life.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I actually, you said something interesting there. Like, I wanted to know maybe a little bit more, like, you know, right after the Pan Am, like how long did you have to kind of wait for that like next opportunity to come up? Was there strategies that you were able to try to cope with that? Or like, how did you feel really in that moment when you didn't really have that next step?
I mean, I've been kind of used to it, right? Because when I was working at the Banff Center, so I left out some stops in my experience. Like the year after Banff, I lived at home with my parents, but I worked like an administrative job back at York University, actually. And I also was like an associate producer for a local theater company in York Region. And so I'd kind of been used to jumping from contract to contract, so to speak, not having things lined up. And so I was familiar with like the things you got to do to set yourself up for your next role. So I was at the Pan Am Games, you know, I signed a 6-month contract. And they had extended me again to do some like wrap up work after the games. But I, you know, everyone in that office knew that their time was going to come to an end. And so what was really fascinating about that experience was, because everyone there knew that their time was temporary, it was so open and transparent about like, oh yeah, I'm looking for this job. I'm looking for this job. Have you looked here? Have you thought about here? Oh, these people are looking for, you know, people with these skills, which is like very, very bizarre, but it was awesome. In that environment, that's how I heard about the Treasury Board opportunity to be a senior risk analyst. And I ended up applying for it. And very luckily, I got offered the job within like a 4-week turnaround time, which is very, very quick for government to do that for open roles. And so there actually wasn't a waiting period between the Pan Am experience and the Treasury Board experience. And I credit that mostly because the environment I was working in, like everyone was hunting for their next role, right? And you know, for me, I'll be honest, like my motivation was strictly because I just finished an MBA. I got to find a way to pay for this degree that I just finished, right? And now it's become my whole career. So like, it's pretty crazy how things work.
Yeah, nice. It's like the strength of the network effects that you can have, right? Being one of the most important kind of insurance policies, I guess.
Yeah. I don't want to, you know, pat myself too heavily on the back, but being liked by your colleagues definitely helps, right? Because they're the ones who are going to tell you about the things that are out there, right? So I have a feeling that if I wasn't very nice to get along with, or if I wasn't a good productive member of the workforce, I might not end up, you know, where I am right now. So
that's really interesting, Albert. I wondered if you could just tell me a little bit more about what exactly risk management is as a field, and just as like a bit of a background. Like, I started my career as an economist, so like I have like an intuitive and like financial understanding of risk management. Like, you know, I'm really glad I only put 2% of my portfolio in crypto. That was a great risk management strategy as of like the last month. But like, beyond just the kind of personal finance and, you know, financial economics, can you give me a little bit more of a like a background around that?
Yeah, for sure. I'll be honest, like I'll just start with this preface that if you have a bias that risk management is very boring, you got to chuck that bias at the window, because risk management is like a crazy exploding field right now. If you were to look back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, risk management was mostly associated with like economics or insurance. Now risk management has like spawned out into so many different, like even individual fields, like subcategories within risk management. So for risk management, it's really about, it's a decision-making framework, right? And so people who work in risk management not only build the frameworks for decision-making within institutions and organizations, but they also are acting as advisors and effective challengers of certain decisions, right? So the ultimate risk management methodology that even we use in our day-to-day life is this idea of like likelihood and severity. What's the likelihood of something bad happening? And what's the severity of that bad thing happening? Now, there are different scales and depths and even areas of expertise where you can apply that framework. If you were to apply it to, I don't know, a fraud perspective, from the banking industry perspective, there's so many exposures from a risk perspective when it comes to people trying to, you know, defraud financial institutions. So you could specialize in that: likelihood, severity of someone taking over someone's account, likelihood of someone, you know, stealing someone's identity and applying for, you know, for a financial product. But then there are other higher and higher levels of that framework that can be applied at the strategic decision-making level about like, hey, where is this industry going? What's the likelihood of the industry moving, you know, you mentioned crypto, but like more towards cryptocurrency versus traditional currencies? What's the severity of that against our business? Or you can apply it more to an operational perspective, which is like, what's the likelihood that, you know, we're going to be able to, on a consistent basis, send out our statements on time to our customers? Really, like risk management is really all about that framework. And so where I started in risk management at the Pan Am Games was more so from an operational perspective, right? Which is like, we've got, you know, a bunch of different events happening at the same time across the GTA. How are they all going to run smoothly? And how is the province going to stay coordinated on those things? So that's where I started from an operational perspective. And then when I moved to Treasury Board, it was actually more of the decision-making framework perspective, which is like, what's the type of framework we should apply? Is our likelihood scale, like, how do we define highly probable? right? How do we define low severity? How do we define remote severity? Like the decision-making for American Crafting, that was a big part of my time at the Treasury Board. And then educating people about how to use that framework, everywhere from, you know, senior executives down to, business analysts. And then when I moved to WSIB, it was very much the same thing about putting that framework into action and then reporting on, like, what are the top risks of our business on a quarterly basis to the board of directors. And then when I moved over to banking, what's fascinating about banking is that the risk management perspectives there are like, there's so much risk in banking. So everything from, you know, credit risk to you know, operational risk to reputational risk. And so my role when I was working in banking has really been like, how do we stay as well managed as possible across all these functions at a high level? So like across all of our processes, how are we staying coordinated and how are we minimizing risk for our customers and for the business at the same time? Cool. So that's kind of like how I've approached risk management, how the industries look like from my perspective.
I have a follow-up to that, Albert, but can you just clarify what WSIB is?
All right, WSIB, Workplace Safety and Insurance Board. Yeah.
Okay, that's a provincial?
It's a provincial agency. And so what they do is they're a no-fault liability insurer for workplace injuries. So anyone at work slips and falls, no one's liable, but WSIB will basically provide salary while they're missing work. So they're basically a provincial insurer.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds like there's a lot of subfields and applications from like operations to credit risk, but it almost sounds like risk management is like thinking about like logistics, like from like a military perspective, but in a probabilistic way, right? Like for Panning Games, you're thinking about all the logistics of it, but then assigning like risk around it. Like, is that kind of accurate, or for at least that instance?
Yeah, I mean, if I were to put it into like a specific scenario, you can apply the risk management framework to like anything that you do in your life, right? I'll give you an example, right? I don't know, Jared, I don't know if you own a bike or not, but it's like, I'm going to go bike to work today. If you apply a risk management framework to that, it's like, okay, what's the worst thing that can happen to me while I'm going to bike to work? You know, it's Toronto, so, you know, you could get, you know, struck by a vehicle, hopefully not. Your bike could get stolen, like all these areas or risks that could impact your ability to actually successfully ride your bicycle, right? And so what's the severity and likelihood of each of those scenarios? And then based on that, where would you invest most of your time to mitigate risk? If you're most worried about your bike being stolen, and that's the highest severity based on your perspective, you would invest in really good bike locks, and you just choose to make that incremental investment in that area. If you're really worried about other cars possibly, you know, harming you while you're on the road, you basically maybe change your decision to say, you know, I'm not going to bike to work. I'm actually going to do something different and use a different mode of transportation. So if you apply that framework to, you know, the Pan Am Games about like, here are all the things that can happen. Like, I remember like we would talk about, it's crazy we're in a pandemic right now, but we talked about like, what happens if a pandemic happens during the Pan Am Games? Like, what will we do, right? Like, it was really, really fascinating to work in that environment. And so we apply the same, I've applied the same framework across all of my stops and risk management, right? Which is like across all these different risk exposures, we only have so much money and time to invest. So where would we invest it to reduce risk based on its overall severity and likelihood?
So in my mind, I see it as like two fundamental points, right? There's like this gathering, like what are all these possibilities? And then there's like almost this weight assignment of like severity or cost and then also probability. Is that kind of right about what the framework part is? And then if you're a risk manager, is your focus mainly on one of those two things, or are you responsible for putting that whole kind of model together?
Yeah. So like I said before, like there are so many different roles in risk management, right? So like where I started was assembling the framework, right? What's the decision-making framework? Well, how would we define, you know, a level 10 severity versus a level 1 severity? What's the sliding scale? And how would we define very likely versus remote? Right, or highly probable versus remote. I don't know. It depends on where you work. They all use different words, but they all mean the same thing, right? So
would you like be quantifying that as like numbers, or is that then, are you just categories or
Yeah. So great question, Jared. Yeah. So severity a lot of the times is split up into multiple categories, right? So because not all risk is the same. You can't compare, you know, specifically operational risk to financial risk, right? And so you'd have categories like, I don't know, financial impact, and your severity scale from 1 to 10, depending on the size of your organization, I'm just making this up. We're going to say severity 10 is a $10 million loss, whereas severity one is like a less than $500,000 loss. That's one category. You'd also have another category, which could be like reputationally, we're in the news nonstop for like a whole year. That's like a severity 10 versus like level one is like someone tweets at us. And so when you break it down across these different exposures, which traditionally follow financial, reputational, sometimes strategic, depending on the industry you work in, like regulatory scrutiny or pressure, you get actually a very dynamic scale you can look at and say, okay, how should I be weighing this decision, right? Because the financial risk for something might be really low, but the reputational scrutiny you might get out of that decision outweighs that substantially. What as risk managers, what we do is, aside from if we build the framework, assuming someone else has built the framework and you're a risk manager applying that framework, you're basically asking the people who own the decision to be like, what are you comfortable with? If you were, you know, once we lay this out on the scale, what are you comfortable with? And also the different thing is that everyone in the room, when you have these conversations, has different risk appetites, right? And you see it in time, like I'm going to go back to the bike example. You see it all the time in Toronto. There are people who don't wear helmets when they ride their bicycle, which I think is like crazy. And they don't, sometimes there are people who are biking in Toronto right now in the middle of winter when it's like the roads are icy without helmets. I'm like, okay, you know, good on you. Whereas other people would be like, I'm never biking in winter, or like, I'm always going to wear a helmet. When you have this confluence of different perspectives and ideas on a specific decision, you get a really dynamic conversation. And then the risk manager has to facilitate all those different views to make sure everyone feels heard. And make sure that, you know, we present to that ultimate decision maker, which is traditionally an executive or, you know, a senior leader, say, hey, this is the conversation we had. This is the recommendation we came to. And this is why.
Yeah, this sounds like it's not only forecasting and like quantizing risk, but you really have to have some interpersonal skills in order to be able to like extract the values from your clients, I guess, at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. And it's really unfortunate because like I think in Hollywood, risk managers get a bad rap. I don't know if anyone ever saw the movie Along Came Polly in like 2000, whatever, with like Jennifer Aniston and Ben Stiller, where it's like, he's a risk manager. He's like super scared. He's like super shy and awkward. In order to be successful working in risk management, like you have to be like the opposite of all those things. Now, you have to be a really dynamic communicator. You have to be really inclusive as a facilitator. You also got to be able to like summarize your findings from a conversation and sometimes even know who are the people to invite to the meeting. Ultimately, like I, you know, as a risk manager, like I work at a bank, like I don't have immense fraud experience, but I need to know who the experts in fraud I would need to bring in to make sure the conversation is well structured and that we're getting the perspectives we need to come to the right decision, right?
Albert, in terms of these like categories, like, you know, okay, this, we lose money for the next 10 years, we lose money for 1 year, like these different categories that you're coming up with or that like a framework has been built around. So from a statistical perspective, when I'm trying to calculate like the expected risk of that, I would just like assign a probability to each of these discrete categories and then like some measure of loss and then just add them up or average them, I should say. Is that how it happens in risk management? Is it just like an expected average over the different outcomes weighted by their likelihood?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I think risk management, it's always like part art, part science, because there's parts of risk that you can quantify and measure and statistically assign a value to, right? Like an example from like a credit risk perspective, you have a degree of accuracy in terms of your ability to forecast. You know what interest rates are going to look like for the next quarter. You know customers of a certain credit score will perform this way, customers of a certain income will perform this way, because you got all this data, so you can make a good quantitative assessment. That's just one element of it, right? There's a whole other slew of elements, which is more the art side, which is like, from an operational perspective, do we know even as our company we're able to deliver this new product or service the same way we deliver the old products and services, right? And so it's a combination of weighing like the accuracy of the financial risk as well as the more qualitative area of like reputational risk and operational risk, where it's not so easy to be statistically accurate. And so as a risk manager, you have to be able to not overweigh any particular area of risk exposure or weigh the one that's actually the most important based on the values you have as a company. So like if your company say like, hey, we're going to do everything we can for the customer, and that's your core objective and priority as a company, as a risk manager, you would probably want to say in that conversation, well, it's going to make us a ton of money. Is that the best outcome for the customer from a risk perspective? Reputationally, is that going to look good for us amongst our customers? Is that going to build brand equity? So it really depends where you work. But like, if I was going to a more traditional sense, you know, say if I was a specialist in credit risk, then I would say, yes, statistically speaking, they would be fairly accurate at sizing and projecting likelihoods of risk to a degree. But if you're working in an area like operational risk, your conversations are going to be entirely different. You don't have that statistical foundation to work off of necessarily, depending where you work.
I remember like in our economics classes, they said like, this goes back to the idea of like Frank Knight, that there's this difference between risk and uncertainty. And like uncertainty is not fundamentally quantifiable, or I might have it backwards, but one of the two. So it like this idea that you can always assign a probability on risk, I think is what you're saying, is like that's not the case. And it's specifically not the case in some areas where there's just less information.
Yeah, honestly, like risk management is about managing uncertainty, right? Like I'll give you an example. Like this past week, I think everyone, I don't know if I look at certain Reddit forums, so I say everyone, but I'm only talking about the community of Reddit, right? So it's like, everyone's like, hey, yeah, the Bank of Canada's got to be raising interest rates. They got to be raising interest rates. And the announcement came, and then the Bank of Canada didn't raise interest rates, right, for the last quarter. So, like, that's a perfect example of, like, despite the fact that, you know, you could have this view that this likelihood of this scenario is going to happen, it actually still might not. So, like, from a risk management perspective, you would assign likelihood and, you know, and severity of these decisions and these outcomes, and plan for each possible direction that could materialize out of it.
This reminds me of, there's like that 2x2 table that's like, you know, your known knowns, your known unknowns, your unknown knowns, and your unknown unknowns. I wonder, I guess specifically, when you're doing your risk management, and maybe this is a personal choice, how do you take into account those unknown unknowns? Do you always leave room for that? Or is that something that's outside of the job description?
That's a tough one. Like I can only speak probably from my experience, right? Which is a lot of the times, like when we're applying these risk management frameworks, they're built on specific areas of risk exposures. I'll give you an example. Like a risk activity you could do for an assessment is you could run a diagnostic exercise. Kind of like when you go to your doctor and you do your annual checkup, they're like, you know, how's your mental health? How are your joints? How's this? And they do like a full scale assessment end to end. You can do the same thing from a risk perspective, being like, hey, from a credit perspective, do you have any credit exposure? No? Great, let's move on. Operationally, reputationally, you can go down the list and ask all these questions from a diagnostic perspective and get a fulsome understanding of the level of risk something has. From an unknowns unknowns perspective, the tricky part is, because they're unknown unknowns, a lot of times, I hate to say this, in the business world, at least at my level, I'm not an executive, right? At least at my level, I feel like the time isn't there to have those conversations, because you can just get into a, you know, this rabbit hole of like so many possible scenarios that could be extremely high severity but extremely low likelihood. And so what's the point of having that conversation? I don't know if that makes any sense, but
yeah. So you're almost assuming that your unknown unknown space is so small that then it will be built into kind of your uncertainty estimates for everything.
Yeah,
else maybe.
Yeah, and I would say like where the, like these like large like black swan events, which are like high severity, but you know, fairly remote likelihoods. Traditionally speaking, like somewhere like a business continuity office might come in for some of those things. But yeah, that's kind of like how IVA was treated it.
And just as a last thing, like you said the black swan events, but I know already for Pan Am, you were thinking about pandemics. Because I think when people think of black swan events right now, they think of COVID-19. Would that have counted as a black swan event to you? Or what does that mean then when you're thinking about that kind of a term or that kind of an event?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I was in the Pan Am Games, I was an analyst. And I think, you know, as early in my career, so I kind of took it all for granted, but someone somewhere was paid to come up with a list of like black swan events. I just remember there was a day where we did this, we call them tabletop exercises, where you sit around a table, but you talk about what would we do if this happened. One of them was like a pandemic. Another one was like, a terrorist attack on the GO train, like terrifying, right? But like all these things like came up, and like what would we do if they interfered with the games? I have a feeling that the appetite to spend time investigating black swan events and what would we do if these circumstances would happen are truly based on like the objectives of an institution, right? So if the province is running the Pan Am Games, their core priority actually is like, obviously the game's going smoothly, but like public health and safety, right? That's got to be like number one. And so obviously you're going to put down things that could compromise public health and safety while this huge mass of people are influxing into the city of Toronto. Whereas I think if you work in another institution, you know, if you're an insurer, a black swan event, I don't know, I was going to say climate change isn't really a black swan event anymore, but like you, traditionally speaking, you'd focus more on things that are a bit more certain that, that happen more regularly versus more randomly. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, yeah, I think, I mean, I think I'm pushing you on a topic that's not necessarily covered very much. So it's insightful though to get your opinion on it. That was what I was hoping for.
Maybe before we leave this topic though, Albert, I think I feel like I have to bring it up because Black Swan has been mentioned like three times now. Is, do you have any thoughts about Nassim Taleb and like his implications and his work on risk management?
Honestly, so it's funny. I've worked in risk management for 5 years. I've got 3 certificates in risk management. I actually haven't heard that name before. So
okay.
Maybe it's some reading I got to do, but I don't know. I wouldn't know.
Okay, he wrote the book called The Black Swan back in 2008 or so, I think. So that's what popularized it. He's got very controversial views, but he's had, like, for example, he had some thoughts during the pandemic that, like, because of like tail, he's obsessed about tail risks. So like because of tail risks, for example, like when a pandemic starts, you always have to overreact. Doesn't mean you have to overreact after you know the implications of the pandemic, but you just don't know, like, is this going to be like a SARS? Is it going to be a swine flu? You know, you have to kind of assume the tail risk because the tail risk's expected cost is so, so large that even if there's a small probability, basically like you should overreact to small probabilities when the impact is like exponential kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there's a whole area of risk management. It's called key risk indicators. It's basically like any other metric, but it's like, what are the leading indicators, right? And so I think for COVID-19 and the pandemic, like there actually were a ton of leading indicators. I mean, I'm saying this now in retrospect, right? But there are a ton of leading indicators that could have you understand what the impact could be. Whereas it's a bit more difficult in a more traditional black swan scenario, like, I don't know, a tsunami in Lake Ontario, right? Like they're a bit harder. You can't actually get leading indicators very easily. But yeah, that's a fascinating concept to say, like, if I got a leading indicator and while the likelihood, we actually don't even know the likelihood because we're so uncertain, it makes sense to do a bunch of upfront investment to get an understanding of what additional investments we'd have to make to mitigate risk is a really interesting thought on the tail risk side.
All right, so I was hoping as well we could talk a little bit about your new role where you've transitioned kind of into data management now. I think that this topic is a bit relevant to both Eric and my career because we're both working as data scientists. And so to be able to get that kind of perspective where you're actually trying to craft some of the policies, it sounds like, around the data we would actually work with, if that's a correct interpretation.
Yeah, it largely is. And so, like, why don't I talk about the transition from risk to data to begin with? Like, I mean, there's a couple things. Like I mentioned before, I'm doing risk for a while. But data management, I actually equate with data risk. It's just a more specialized form of risk. I would talk about credit risk and fraud risk and all that sort of stuff. It's just another subcategory, in my opinion, which is that every company right now, whether they admit it or not, are basically looking at themselves in the mirror and saying, what are we doing with customer information or, like, you know, people information, and are we managing it ethically and properly within the bounds of the law and within the bounds of what we need as a business? And you see it all the time. Like, I feel like every month there's like a cyber breach, and every couple of weeks some social media giant's getting fined or whatever. And customers themselves, like people themselves, like, I maybe ask a question back to you and to both of you, which is like, Eric and Jared, do you know where your information is?
I mean, I know where some of the hospital information is because I work at SickKids, but I mean, do I know, like, literally, like,
how you, I'm talking about you, your information, where, do you know where it is?
No, I mean, I assume it lives in like some like air conditioned data storage in like Oregon State or something.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. And actually, hopefully, maybe you can correct me if I'm like taking the entirely wrong tack. But I've always been of the opinion that's like, as long as I trust the company somewhat, then the more people that have my information, the better, because it becomes a little bit less valuable. But that's from like the perspective of people selling me things. But I haven't really maybe taken into account the risk of a, you know, banking breach or something, which I'm a little bit more stingy about about my banking information.
Yeah.
I hope I should be.
Yeah. It's fascinating, right? Like, so both of you basically express that, like, I mean, Eric, physically you have an idea of where your information is, probably like in Arizona in some air conditioned warehouse, right? But like, if you asked anyone on the street, like, you know, your information is on the internet, can you give me a list of all the places where you think your information is? Like, they would struggle to be able to answer that correctly. I even struggle to answer that correctly. And we're seeing, I guess, a lot of government regulation going, you know, in Europe and even here in North America, is like, as a customer, you own your information. You're allowed to decide who has it, who keeps it, for how long, where it goes. I think it's a really important concept. It's a fundamental right, I think, for anyone to have. I mean, it's your property if you think about it. So the challenge that a lot of companies have is they've been collecting information on customers for, what, decades now, where these rules weren't in place. And so if someone says, you know, if a government says, hey, now, Jared, you have the right to say where your information is and isn't, some companies don't even know they have your information, Jared or Eric, right? You know what I mean? Like, oh, we have a file on Jared Hunter. I had no idea we had a file on Jared Hunter. That's crazy. But like they wouldn't know. They'd have to know that to be able to verifiably tell you back, yes, we have your information, what do you want to do with it? So from a data management perspective, and that's just one area of data management, but from a data management perspective, the biggest risk that I think that we have is a lot of companies honestly don't even know what they have about people. And that's a problem, right? From like if you were to extend it to a cyber perspective, that's a huge problem. If someone were to break into anyone's data warehouse, take a bunch of information, and then someone said, okay, what did they actually steal? They'd be like, I don't know. that's not a great answer, right? So data management's all about mitigating ultimately that risk at the introductory level, right? So all of the work that I'm doing right now is tied to being like, what do we actually have? Like, what do we actually have as an institution? Not just about people, but in general, right? And let's like find a way to categorize this as much as we can. And so I'll give you an example. Like if you had an attic and it was just full of boxes, but none of the boxes were labeled, like I said, if someone broke into your house and like stole stuff from your attic and someone said, what did they steal from your attic? You wouldn't know. But if you start to label stuff in your attic and say like, oh yeah, this box was kitchen stuff. I have 5 boxes of kitchen stuff. I've got 3 boxes of DVDs, you know? And you were to even map it down to a more specific level, within this box was 5 pans, 2 pots, whatever. Then you could do an inventory on a regular basis and know what is there. And then you can make a decision on what do I actually need to keep? What can I get rid of? What should I actually have more of? And so like from a risk management perspective, there's a ton of risk if you think about all the information we have about people, any individual company has about people. And getting that categorization right at the right level, and then ensuring consistency in terms of how that information is cataloged and tracked. That's kind of like the big part of data management that I've started working in just in the last 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, it sounds to me like this is even it's the early stages, right? You're trying to even just build out that it's almost like the industry is in that kind of tabletop scenario situation you talked about with Pan Am, where you're literally just trying to figure out where the value is, where are the things that we're exposed to, and like even just what's important.
From a data perspective, a lot of companies probably couldn't even size a likelihood severity situation from a data management risk perspective because they actually don't know what they have. So how do you get to that point is you get an understanding of what's actually there is the first step. And what I'm saying is more of like broad frameworks. Like a lot of companies are fairly mature in terms of knowing what they have. There's an element of just ensuring consistency on an ongoing basis. But then like as you move down this kind of data management journey of like, okay, now I know what's here. There's another element of like, again, the second part of decision making of like, what should I be getting rid of, and what should I be keeping? And that's actually really hard because the requirements that set out what to keep and what to get rid of. You've got business factors, you've got government regulation, sometimes you got lawsuits like that require information from the past, you got audit trails and stuff like that, you know, from a taxation and audit perspective. So there's tons of different rules or, you know, individuals or groups that say, hey, this information should be held this way. And sometimes they conflict with each other, right? You might have an internal policy that says, yeah, you can get rid of something after 7 years. But then, like, you know, if a legal department says, hey, actually, we've got this lawsuit from 15 years ago, we can't get rid of it. You got to make sure that you're communicating with those different stakeholders, so you're managing it properly, right?
It sounds like a really, like frustrating job, though, sometimes, Albert. Is this fun to do? I mean, you got, like, lawyers and data people and the government. It sounds like all, like, sides are coming at you. Is that okay, like, on a day-to-day basis, or is it overwhelming?
Well, I would say, like, well, I'm still pretty new to the job, so I'm going to say it's overwhelming. But it's overwhelming in a good way, right? Because there's a ton of learning that can be done within the data management space. And, like, I think a big part of, like, why I moved over and why I've been successful in my career is that, like, if you think about risk management and data management, and you were to add the word extrovert to those job categories, you traditionally would say you wouldn't expect extroverts in those categories. No offense, I know you both work in data management. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't traditionally expect extroverts to be working in that area, but I'm a huge extrovert. And so I think that's served as an asset for me because I'm able to be a great communicator between different groups, be a great facilitator, come to good conclusions as a great communicator, ultimately, if I pat myself on the back that way.
I just ask, because you mentioned government regulation, and again, I know you're kind of new to the sector, so your thoughts are probably still, you know, forming, but my sense is that the whole various regulatory requirements across countries is a total, like, nightmare and headache and counterproductive. So, like, famously, Europe has GDPR, which I never really remember what it stands for. I think it's general data protection something, but, like, that has all sorts of requirements about data. Like, Canadian healthcare data has to be stored in Canada. There's all sorts of, like, requirements like that. Like, I feel like that really limits the actual business value of a lot of data sets, right? If they're, like, all these various costs and requirements and silos. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say that I think the world is still figuring that out. Because you're right, yeah, GDPR is one. I mean, Canada, we've got PIPEDA. In the U.S., I don't know what the U.S. regulation is called, but either way, like, there are some requirements that are, like, you know, if it's data about, I don't know if this is true. I haven't read thoroughly on GDPR, but it's like, you know, if the customer is a European customer and they're from Europe, the data needs to be stored in Europe. But, like, that doesn't work anymore. Like, we're all cloud-based. So, like, it could be actually in Arizona in an AWS warehouse, right? Like, Amazon Web Services warehouse. So I think, like, the regulation, because the industry is changing so fast and the infrastructure is changing so quickly that I think a lot of regulation is still kind of, like, catching up on an ongoing basis, not just to, like, with the understanding what's happening from that perspective, but also what other countries are doing. And so, interestingly, GDPR is, I think they're one of the first, it was, like, one of the first pieces of big data regulation that came out. And I think a lot of countries are looking to them to see, like, where do they go next? But yeah, it's pretty complicated.
Like, I completely understand a lot of the difficulties and just even knowing where all the data lives. And I, Jared, actually, I don't know if you want to take a stab at this, but, like, just even getting data out of the hospitals that we work at respectively is really hard. So in theory, well, no, not in theory, like, literally the data does exist. It's all in our hospitals' respective electronic health record systems. But if you want to say, like, want to know the length of stay of a patient in the hospital, not in a specific department, but actually just overall in the hospital between different departments, like, actually getting that data at SickKids is impossible or just extremely challenging. And I don't mind saying that for the record. I don't know, Jared, if you have any insight into, like, if UHN has a similar challenge there.
Well, UHN is a little bit behind SickKids, actually, because we're still rolling out Epic, which is we're rolling out an electronic health records system. So a lot of our records are still very siloed. So it's impossible to get it all together to make those kind of insights. Yeah, I think I wonder too, it would be difficult to even know what are the information that you can even extrapolate from, right? Because it's like, you know, we have these rows and we have these actual values, but there's actually more information you can then know about, say, whatever patient or customer in a finance industry versus a patient in healthcare, because there's a bunch of information you can extrapolate from the data that you already have. So taking into that kind of risk of what would it be, derived data and derived information from the data you already have, even though you're not directly measuring it, that would be something tricky to handle, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. The whole, like, from a healthcare perspective, I mean, my healthcare experience is, like, very indirect, right? Because I worked at Workplace Safety and Insurance Board, and we would have to liaise with, obviously, hospitals and doctors. And I remember people would always complain how we would accept faxes, right? Like, traditional, I don't even know where to find a fax machine. I guess at Canada Post. But the reason that is because from a healthcare perspective, the industry, if you think about family care, is so fragmented, where there are some doctors who still rely heavily on fax because they handwrite their prescriptions, they take all their notes, not on the computer, but, you know, on a pad of paper, which then they tear off and they put in your little file. Like, my family doctor growing up, everything was manual and, like, written out. Whereas my family doctor now, he types everything in the computer and it goes to, like, the central database, which I don't even know where it goes. Where is my information? I have no idea. But but it's fascinating, right? Like, how, from an infrastructure perspective, like, there's so much room to grow from a healthcare perspective, which could really change people's understanding of where their health information is, right? So,
yeah. I mean, healthcare data is notoriously balkanized and difficult to access, and that's why so few production-ready systems exist in a healthcare setting, right? So it's like, even if you have some sort of research breakthrough, whether it's genetics or some sort of something under the umbrella of personalized medicine, hospitals just don't actually have the data infrastructure or this, like, a data organization map, the sort of thing that, like, you're sketching out in your job, Albert, to even begin to think how to operationalize it. So the revolution will be TBD in healthcare.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. Like, I think about the question I raised before about, like, retention, how long do you keep it? How long do you keep someone's information about an illness they had when they were a kid? Do you keep it until they die? Do you keep it when they say they don't want you to have it anymore? It's really interesting, actually. I'm thinking about this, like, it's a pretty big question. So, yeah.
I mean, from my perspective, I'd like to keep it forever, because we never know what kind of, even just research questions, we could use that for.
Yeah. But some people might say, hey, if someone were to find out this information about me, they could discriminate me against. Because they, you know, I had this particular illness growing up, and people could assume that, you know, I am of a certain subculture and my employer doesn't like that subculture. You know, it's they ask a lot of really interesting questions when it comes to healthcare information.
Yeah, we don't want to turn into Gattaca, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a movie about genetics, for anyone who's not familiar with it. I want to know, how useful has your theater degree been? Were those production practicum courses managing students, first year students, how helpful has that been as you've gone through your career, I guess?
Yeah. And for context, to our listeners, at York, you would be a crew chief, I think is what they called it. And so you would be responsible for supervising a group of first year theater students in crew, which is like backstage work in the carpentry shop or in the wardrobe shop or whatever, which is pretty cool. So the practicum experience at York, and more generally, like, the theater degree that I got, it taught me some really great fundamental skills that I think, like, have basically directly led to my ability to move careers so easily, which is, first off, like, at York, I kind of just throw you into it, right? Like, hey, I guess you're in charge of the carpentry team now for this whole show. And it's like, I don't think I'm an expert carpenter. And, like, well, you figure it out. You figure out how to mentor these people, right? And so kind of being thrown into that, it gives you this ability to be flexible and to know how to effectively learn on the fly, which is really hard for some people to do, right? Some people find it very unsettling to be tossed into something new and don't want to have those experiences, right? Whereas I think, like, the theater experience gave me a lot more courage to be willing to say, like, yeah, sure, I'll do this. Yeah, sure, I'll do that. The second thing too is, like, from practicum experience, like, it really felt like work experience. And I think it's funny, all through my career, and if I go to my career working in retail in university, you know, to pay the bills, to, you know, where I am today, a big comment that I've always gotten is, like, Albert's very professional. He's got, like, this high degree of, like, professional integrity and attitude. And I know it sounds like a given professional attitude and integrity, but like there are some people who it takes a while for them to learn those things. It takes them a while to learn, you know, how to show up on time, how to be fully prepared for a meeting, you know, how to be fully prepared for a presentation, how to be fully prepared for questions that might come up in a meeting that you're not sure you're going to be asked or not, right? Like all those things, all that preparedness has really helped me in my work. And so, yeah, like honestly, the theater degree, like it's done so much for me. It's given me the ability to express my ideas, my creative ideas in a succinct way. It's given me the idea to negotiate, to be a facilitator of negotiation between sometimes two very different divergent opinions, right? Like in theater, we would have designers who would want, you know, XYZ, and then we'd have the production house, which would basically be like, hey, we can't actually do that, or like this is what we can do instead. And like finding the balance between those two perspectives is notoriously difficult. And it gets even harder in business context too, because everyone wants to do something that they feel is right. And so how do you find the right balance between the two? So yeah, it's kind of like my long-winded answer of how it's helped. But yeah, communication skills, huge plus, professional attitude, and willingness to learn.
Yeah, I also wondered, did you find, so I guess there's a theory around education that it's like the main effect of it is like signaling, in that the fact that you've gotten this degree shows people that you have a certain set of skills. And I wonder, your MBA that you completed after you'd finished at York, how critical do you think that was to your ability to transition out of the arts? Because a BFA is really sold as kind of a very specific degree, even though, as you've discussed, and as I know, because we both took the same degree, there's a lot of soft skills that you really have to hone in that field. So I wonder how much of an effect was it that people didn't necessarily believe you? And so did you need that MBA to actually show people, oh, look, this is something that is known to be general and known to be for business? Did that factor into it?
I hate to admit it, but yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I remember when I was working, you know, at West Band Center, I was working with, there was like, it was Live with Kelly, you know, Kelly Ripa, yeah, Regis and Kelly anyway, but it was when Regis retired and Kelly Ripa came to Banff and she was filming a show Live with Kelly at the Banff Center, which was really cool. Cause I got, you know, a Twilight star like stepped my foot at one point. I was like, wow, it's so cool. A celebrity like ran into me and hurt me. Anyway, but so I was on the phone with like this like project manager from Live with Kelly. And even though like I felt like we had the same job, I knew based on like where he was in his career that he was getting paid like way more than me, right? Like guaranteed paying way more than me. I was like, man, like. And so I LinkedIn stalked a couple of people and I was like, wow, they all came from, you know, interesting backgrounds. They all had this business thing. And deep down, I'm like, okay, you know, there's an element of signaling like you're talking about that's almost required to move in increasing positions of, from an income perspective anyway. And so like, I was like, okay, so what's the right thing that I could, what's the thing I could do to do that signal? And the MBA stood out to me for sure. And honestly, like, I'll be honest, my MBA, it taught me a lot of things. It taught me a foundational accounting and economic skills and all that sort of stuff. But ultimately, like what the MBA taught me was how to speak like business people speak. Like you learn a completely different language when you're in the MBA. It's like, they're not my teammates, you know, they're stakeholders. It's like, not what we're trying to sell, it's our value proposition. Like you just learn these like specific terms that you know, when you apply it to emails and, you know, conversations you have with other people, it layers on this degree of branded credibility, even though at the end of the day, you actually still might be just as qualified even without the MBA. So like, I would say like the MBA does a couple things. It did a couple things for me. I mean, it added three other letters to the end of my name, but it also like changed the way I spoke to my coworkers and to people in the industry. And I think that probably was the biggest difference ultimately.
But so it's almost like there's the cultural norms that you had to learn to show and to relate with other people in those fields.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I'll probably learn a new language then when I'm going into consulting, Albert, just so you know, I'm starting a new job in a week. So I'll have to learn this MBA speak. Maybe I'll hit you up for some tips.
No, you'll pick it up. You'll pick it up very, very, very quickly. It's really not that hard. people will just start using words that you traditionally haven't heard in regular conversation. You're like, oh, okay, I'll mirror those words. And there you go. Don't need a different MBA.
I'm going to use the words margin and lift a lot more. I feel like that will go down well, but we'll have to see.
Yes. Yes, lift. Ugh, we need more lift, yeah.
I think the most important thing for people is that the MBA can really help you with the signaling, and that it's more than just the hard skills that they necessarily teach you, but there's almost like a cultural thing. You got to just kind of embed yourself in that, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. And I think different MBA programs also deliver different pieces of incremental value depending on where you choose to go, right? Like, so if you just want to learn the language and the skills from a course perspective, like any program will do it for you. If you're keen on expanding your network, you know, there are other programs that can help you do that too, right? So yeah, anyone looking to do an MBA, there's tons of different options out there. And I encourage you to think about, what do I want, you know, before you just jump into it. Because it is a very expensive degree. It can be very expensive.
Actually, Albert, I just wanted to ask, you know, back when you were applying to York, when I guess you were like 17 or 18, to do this arts theater degree, and Jared would have been making the same decision at the time. Did young Albert think about like the long run job market implications of that? Or you just wanted to work in the arts and you didn't really think about that when you were that young?
Honestly, I didn't really think about it. It's fascinating that I was able to get away with that. Because I have two older sisters. They both went to Schulich School of Business. My dad was like, yeah, Albert, you should go like do something like that. I'm like, nah, I'm going to go do this this theater thing. Honestly, I did it because it was what made me happy. You know, I actually followed my authentic self in that moment. And it was totally, totally worth it. You know, I think it's really important to be as authentic as you can. I mean, at the end of the day, like there's always going to be drivers that force you down certain paths. But early in life, you know, it's hard. Let's put it this way. When you're young, like I feel like that's the opportunity to go ahead and make mistakes and do these things because the world is a lot more forgiving. Whereas, you know, now it's a bit harder. Like if I went the opposite way, I did business and I said, now I want to go, you know, work in theater. The journey would be not only way more difficult, but also it would impact a ton of other decisions or things going on in my life right now. Right. So I feel like stakes are low. I went ahead and did what I wanted. And so that was, yeah, no regrets there.
Okay. So here we'll move on to our infamous section, overrated, underrated, where I'll give you a short phrase or maybe one word, and you can just tell us if it's an underrated thing or an overrated thing, and maybe a brief why. All right?
Deal.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So here we go. Pan Am Games.
Ouch. Underrated. And because it's actually the second biggest games after the Summer Olympics. Bigger than Winter Olympics.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How much bigger?
Oh, I don't remember the numbers, but
fair enough.
It's huge. Also, they got some weird sports in there. Sorry, I'm going to jump in. They got like rollerblade figure skating. The only competitive, you know, space you can watch that, Pan Am Games. So.
Oh, wow. I'm going to actually check that out. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Let me ask a quick follow-up. How would you rank the Pan Am Games relative to other big non-Olympics ones? So like the Commonwealth Games, things like that. Is it right after the Olympics, or do you have it in a hierarchy?
I don't have it in a hierarchy because honestly, I don't watch enough international sport to know. Yeah, because there's Gold Coast Games for Australia, there's Commonwealth Games. Yeah, it's tricky. I actually don't know where I'd rank it. But it's definitely underrated because people always shun it. But it's actually it takes a huge effort to host a Pan Am Games.
Yeah, I just kind of brushed it aside when I was here in Toronto, and that was maybe a missed opportunity.
That's where Andre DeGrasse got his start, the Canadian sprinter, right? So.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Next one. Settlers of Catan.
Overrated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, overrated because I think it's gotten too popular, you know, which is unfortunate. But it's too popular. So you have a lot of people who say like I love Catan, but actually deep down they don't like Catan because they're afraid of saying I don't like Catan. Yeah, so I think it's actually overrated. Even though I love the game myself, I play it all the time.
Do you have any? Yeah, and I know that's why I put it on here. But I was wondering if you had any expansion recommendations for someone who's a Catan lover. And I was not expecting underrated, that's for sure, or overrated. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, I don't play much of the expansions. I play mostly the base game. But I hear Seafarers is a really good one. It's like where you like build boats and then like go across the water and discover new land. I haven't played it yet though.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Defi finance or the crypto market in general.
Overrated. And I say that not based on any foundational fact, because I don't invest in crypto. I don't know anything about crypto other than that it exists. I just think that people are not realizing, you know, some of the fundamental problems with crypto, and that like there's no like actual basis underneath it. And then also like the fact that it's like killing the environment. People don't acknowledge that either. There's a huge carbon impact. So I think it's like hugely overrated.
Okay, cool. Sign up bonuses for customers on online banking.
Online banking's overrated because a lot of the banks will have you meet all these conditions for a very, very long amount of time. And then the fees are especially punitive if you're unable to meet those commitments. Also, it's a huge hassle to change your primary banking relationship. Now, I'm referring to big five banks largely. But yeah,
they're the ones who have most of this, I think.
Yeah, I think it's overrated. Like, I remember one time I went to a bank and be like, hey, I get a free TV if I move over here. And they're like, yeah, here's what you need to do. And I actually read the thing and I was like, oh my gosh, I don't think I can do this. So yeah, I think it's overrated.
All right, good to know. Toronto Maple Leafs.
I'm a huge fan, but they're overrated. The reason being is because they haven't won anything since 1967. So that hurts my feelings to say. I love watching the Leafs, but I think they're overrated.
Okay, fair enough. This one, I'm not sure if you've heard about it, but it seems like it's gone pretty viral. Wordle.
Yeah, I think it's overrated a little bit because I think there are better word games. I get how it's like a short, you know, each day I get to do something. But like, I think there are just better word games out there that have existed for longer, like Scrabble, you know?
Yeah. It's such a time commitment, Scrabble, though.
I mean, but you can play online now where you can like do a turn and leave, you know? So, you know, anyway.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Okay, cool. Vaccine mandates.
Oh, controversial one.
I thought I'd throw it in there. You do have the option to pass if you want, but let's go for it.
It's a binary choice, overrated or underrated. But like, I kind of just want to say, like, fine. You know? Like, I don't want to call them underrated or overrated. I think they're just responsible.
I think you can go with accurately rated, too.
Accurately rated. There you go.
Jared and Albert, can you guys define what do you mean by a vaccine mandate? I mean, it can mean as limited as you can't go into a movie theater or you have to, like, you know, sacrifice your firstborn child. Like, what do you mean by the vaccine mandate?
My interpretation from Jared's question was the existing mandates that are out right now that are like, you know, you got to show proof of vaccination to go to the cinema, to go to the restaurant, to, you know, board a plane, all that sort of stuff. I think they're accurately rated for the time being based on the level of risk present in society with COVID-19. They could become very overrated or underrated depending on how the pandemic plays out. But I don't know.
I'll step in that too. Yeah, I think I agree with Albert. I like the vaccine mandates as they are set right now, I guess. Though maybe on this one specific thing, it might change here, but the convoy to Ottawa against vaccine mandates.
Yeah, that's a weird one. I've been watching the news on that one. That's a weird one. So all the people in that group, I think for the most part, think they're overrated. But hey, you know, everyone's entitled to an opinion, so I'm not one to fight back.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I guess they have their right to protest. Okay, cool. Last one, rising interest rates.
Rising interest rates. It depends what perspective you have. I think they're underrated because people aren't understanding there's so many people who are so highly leveraged and they don't understand the impact of rising rates. Yeah, I think they're definitely underrated because like the bank didn't raise the rates most recently and I think they should have, but that's my opinion. Yeah, so I think they're underrated, and my definition of that is because it's crazy they're still so low. They should be definitely higher.
The other argument would be with inflation as it is as well.
Yes. Oh yeah, inflation is just crazy. Yeah. Man, I could go in a whole hour. You can do a whole other podcast on the price of groceries.
maybe episode 15. We'll have to see.
I want to ask one business jargony one as well. ESG.
ESG, is that like environmentally, socially something?
Environment, social governance, I believe.
Environment, social governance. See, No, I did my MBA, you know, in 2013, so I was almost 10 years ago. So that term did not come up, interestingly. We got CSR, which is corporate social responsibility, but I think they've added environment instead to make it more wholesome versus just the institution. It's more about the overall environment.
I'll take CSR. I'll re-ask the question with CSR.
Is CSR overrated or underrated? Oh, okay. I think it's overrated because the primary intent. Now, I'm not speaking for all businesses. There are some businesses who are generally have really great CSR. The majority of businesses, in my perception, are using it to build brand equity, right, to drive the growth of their business. But if they were to look inward about like the overall carbon impact of their institution, from supply chain down to whatever widget they produce, I think it's overrated.
I'd just like to thank you again, Albert, for taking time out of your day to come on here with us. I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
All right, cool. So this has been the 14th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast. Thanks to Seth Kitamura for intro music, and thank you for listening. Join us again next time.